polls closed today in Russia, and little surprise, Vladimir Putin is expected to stay eligible for the presidency until 2036.
This sham procedure that Vladimir Putin has organized has nothing, and I want to stress, nothing to do with a genuine democratic vote.
I'm Marco Werman. Also today, a closed border crossing is making a bad problem much worse.
9.3 million people go to bed hungry, food insecure, every day, every night in Syria.
And in Istanbul, the domed and gilded Hagia Sophia today is a museum that wows visitors.
It's one of the most amazing buildings mankind ever created on the surface of the earth.
Now the fate of the former church-turned-mosque-turned-museum will be decided by a court. All of that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're listening to The World. Authorities in Hong Kong used water cannons and pepper spray today to try to beat back protesters. Demonstrators were angry about a new national security law that went into effect today, a law that gives Beijing far-reaching powers over Hong Kong. Security forces in the territory hoisted large purple banners in the streets, explaining parts of the law. They warned that even shouting some slogans can now be interpreted as treason. Still, Hong Kong youth, including Isaac Chung, took to the streets to protest the new measures. Chung is former vice chair of the activist group Democisto, which just disbanded in reaction to the new law.
Today is really chaotic. A lot of tear gas, a lot of pepper spray bombs have been used today. And there is a purple flag made by the Hong Kong police to warn the people that when you are shouting any kind of slogans, when you're shouting banners or flags, you will be touching the bottom line of the national security law.
So lots of people arrested, some estimates to put it at 300, including 9 people arrested under the new law. Are these people who got arrested, are they getting released?
Under the national security law, they can be put in the police stations or put in the investigation room for a really long time, and there is no time limit. And even they can search their house without warrant by the national security law.
So we're seeing reports as well, Isaac, that China's top internal security forces, the People's Armed Police, joined Hong Kong security forces on the front lines in Hong Kong. Did you see that?
Yes, definitely, because the national security law given the power to the secret police, they can execute any kind of actions. So it means that the authorities inside the mainland China can finally come to Hong Kong and do their actions. And the Communist Party hate democracy because they are not elected by a democracy system. So they think that Hong Kong problem is a threat, and they have to use some tools to restrict the power of the people, taking out their civil rights.
I mean, there is concern all over the world about what this security law could mean. Britain says it will offer 3 million Hong Kong residents a chance to settle in the UK and ultimately apply for citizenship. Let's listen to UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson today.
We made clear, Mr. Speaker, that if China continued down this path, we would reintroduce a new route for those with British national overseas status to enter the UK, granting them limited leave to remain with the ability to live and work in the UK and thereafter to apply for citizenship. And that is precisely what we will do now.
Is that a welcome decision by the British Prime Minister?
Yes, this is an important lifeboat for the Hong Kong people who are fighting for democracy and freedom. So we are glad that the government can really take actions to protect the people who are trying to uphold the democracy values. Every government in the foreign country should keep on reviewing the conditions of Hong Kong.
So, Isaac, will you stay in Hong Kong and protest? And will the strategies of last summer still work?
It is hard to say because the situations in the future will be really unpredictable. But I will say that no matter I'm staying or leaving, I will be fighting against this brutal regime from my best.
Are you worried that a lot of Hong Kongers resettling in the UK could basically drain the territory of its activists and also potentially leave Hong Kong to Beijing the way it wants it?
I didn't think so, because I think that Hong Kong people are really in love with their land. So I didn't think that Hong Kong people would surrender and give up so soon until Hong Kong become Hong Kong again. So I have faith in Hong Kong people.
Isaac Chung was among the protesters on the streets of Hong Kong today, protesting a new national security law Beijing has imposed. Isaac is the former vice chair of the now disbanded activist group Demosisto. Isaac, thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
This week, a group of 60 countries and NGOs came together to pledge financial support for Syrians who are still suffering after nearly a decade of civil war. Pledging help is one thing. Getting that help to the people who need it is another. Sometimes the obstacles are maddening. One essential border crossing, for example, between Syria and Iraq has been closed since January. That's made it nearly impossible to get crucial aid to more than a million people in the northern part of Syria. The World's Shirin Jafari reports.
There used to be 5 official border crossings to get humanitarian aid into Syria. But last December, a vote at the UN Security Council effectively closed 3 of those crossings. One of them is called Al-Yarubiya. This border crossing connects northeastern Syria with northern Iraq. When it was closed back in January, 1.4 million Syrians were cut off from outside help. That decision came from Russia and China voting at the Security Council.
They allowed these only 2 border crossings to continue to northwest, and they stopped the other border crossing to the south from Jordan and to the east from Iraq.
Dr. Zahir Sahloul is the head of Med Global, a medical NGO that runs operations inside Syria. Last week, his organization, along with 20 other aid agencies, published an open letter. It urged the UN Security Council to reopen the Al-Yarubiya crossing.
Basically, we wanted to pressure one party, which is Russia, to reconsider its decision.
Sahloul says getting food and aid to that part of Syria has been a huge challenge. Many of the people there had to flee their homes from other parts of the country. And they're running short on food and medical supplies. Baby milk, meat, fruits and vegetables are luxuries, he says. This week, David Beasley, the head of the World Food Program, told the Associated Press that more people will die if nothing is done.
Of a nation of 20 million people, 9.3 million people go to bed hungry, food insecure, every day, every night in Syria. Now, what's also bad is 1 million of those, they don't know where they go get their next meal. They literally are on the brink of starvation.
With most borders closed, some aid has been making its way to northeastern Syria. But first, it must go through the government in Damascus. Zahir Sahloul, the physician, says this is problematic because the Syrian government is known to distribute or withhold humanitarian aid as a political weapon.
You had patients who died because of the government not allowing UN shipment for dialysis patients in Ghouta and other places. And we don't want to have patients unnecessarily dying with COVID because of this bottleneck.
The Syrian mission to the UN did not respond to my request for comment. Conditions inside Syria were bad before the borders closed, but now they're getting worse. The Syrian economy is in freefall. New U.S. sanctions have gone into effect. And then there's the global pandemic.
The work here actually is very difficult.
Sherwan Berry is a physician with the Kurdish Red Crescent in northeast Syria. He's been working there for the past 8 years.
When you are in war zone or conflict zone for a long time, it's too much pressure.
Berry says since the Al-Yarubiya border closed, medical supplies dropped to half. Now he's worried about a potential coronavirus outbreak in displacement camps. So far, a handful of cases have been reported, and he says aid groups are unprepared.
We are lacking a lot of equipment, a lot of personal protection equipment that we need for COVID at least. And I can say we are lucky so far that we didn't face a lot of cases here. So this is the challenge that we are facing.
Meanwhile, this week, the European Union hosted an aid conference to raise money to help with the Syrian refugee crisis. Officials from 60 countries and various NGOs came together over a somewhat patchy video call.
I think we can hear you
Thank
now.
Thank you very much, Excellency.
Do you hear me now?
In the end, they pledged about $8 billion in humanitarian help. That's roughly $2 billion short of what they pledged last year. The UN resolution that led to the closing of Al-Yarubiya will expire next week. Shervan Berry, the doctor in northeastern Syria, says he's hoping the Security Council votes to reopen the border. Lives depend on it, he says. For the world, I'm Shirin Jafari.
When the United Nations was founded 75 years ago, its goal of peace and unity must have seemed really ambitious. The UN was created after World War II. I suppose we can celebrate that we haven't had a World War III yet. But the critics who focus on the failures of the UN, that it's become too bloated and bureaucratic, those voices have only gotten louder. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres argues a stabilizing international body is more important now than ever.
Now it's much more messy. We are moving into a more multipolar world. It's a chaotic world. And then predictability became the name of the game.
That was Guterres in this week's podcast, The Economist Asks, brought to us by The Economist magazine. Anne McElvoy is the host and joins us from London. So Guterres is the top diplomat in the world. He's been in this position since 2017. How does he attempt to win over critics?
He attempts to win over critics partly by defending multilateralism. He is one of those figures on the international stage who does slightly allied populism, racism, anything that isn't multilateral. He thinks it's a very bad thing indeed. He acknowledges that trust is lacking, trust in the international system between the main players, trust in the Security Council, and frankly, trust of a lot of countries as to whether the UN does them any good or not.
We want to listen to the people because we recognize that there is today a fundamental lack of trust between people and institutions. And if we want to move forward, we need to rebuild that trust. And we can only rebuild that trust if you are humble and if you listen.
It's really hard to see how trust can be kind of built right now because we've got cascading crises, right? A pandemic, the resulting economic downturn, a sharper awareness than ever of social and racial inequalities that don't seem to disappear, not to mention tensions rising between the U.S. and China, U.S. and Russia. And the U.N. is in the middle of all of this, whether it's the Security Council or the WHO. What does Guterres see the U.N.'s role being right now, and how assertive does he feel the UN needs to be?
Well, I asked him two things on that score. One is I think the Security Council has become dysfunctional. The really big meetings of the major players in the world. He said that he was effectively keeping Russia, China, America and other main players, trying to keep a balance between them. I didn't get the impression that he thought much was actually happening that was moving forward on that. But I think he does believe that if perhaps medium ranking countries in the rich world and beyond were to step up a bit to the UN, well, that might begin to shift the balance. I think he wants to bring it back to life, also in a period when the US has been largely missing in action at the UN.
I see the UN more and more as a platform in which different stakeholders can come together and in relation to these new challenges of the future, be it climate change, be it the cyberspace, be it the problems of proliferation, they are able to coming together, find new ways of governance.
So, Anne, this is the UN at 75. Another 25 years, the UN at 100. What are the most pressing issues Guterres sees that the UN's going to have to address? I mean, you mentioned a few there. That's going to continue?
He's certainly very exercised about Libya, not just because of the very unstable situation on the ground there after the fall of Colonel Gaddafi and everything that has happened since, but because he thinks it's sucking in medium and large powers. And he means Turkey, he means Egypt and groups with shady connections to the Kremlin and beyond. And he's worried that these places then become a kind of boiling pot in which lots of powers are piling in and the UN is unable to bring down the temperature. That was a matter of great frustration to him. More broadly, I think he wants to see a balance in the international system. He wants to see America re-engaged. He did say he wasn't giving up. He didn't criticize Donald Trump by name, but he did say, this is a long haul. We're not giving up. After all, we've been here 75 years.
Anne McElvoy, host of the podcast The Economist Asks. Thanks for being with us again.
Thanks so much, Marco.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Last night, thousands of residents gathered on the Charles Bridge in Prague in the Czech Republic to eat together and bid farewell to the coronavirus crisis. While the outbreaks may be on the decline in parts of Europe, world health leaders are warning the pandemic is far from over. In fact, the worst is yet to come. The World's Alana Gordon joins us for a check-in.
At the bird's eye global level, when you look at this pandemic, it's actually speeding up. Last week, record numbers of new cases were reported daily, and those records, they just continue to be broken. The number of new cases reported to the World Health Organization, they've surpassed 160,000 cases each day this week.
That is really dire. And of course, we surpassed more than 500,000 COVID-19 deaths worldwide.
It's really hard to comprehend, but it's not all existential. Public health experts I've talked to stress that communities can turn things around at any point, despite the grave challenges. But that requires responding with a kind of comprehensive approach.
So the test, trace, and isolate, that's what you're referring to.
Yep, we've heard it a lot. And basically, it's a combination of just old-fashioned, tested public health tricks. One of them is contact tracing. And actually this week, WHO's director, Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, he stressed that countries just cannot lag on these efforts.
If any country is saying contact tracing is difficult, it is a lame excuse.
And he pointed out that contact tracers in Eastern Congo were able to finally contain the outbreak of Ebola there. So if it's possible in a place that faces a lot of security and health infrastructure challenges, these kinds of tools can adapt and be really useful in all kinds of environments.
You know, Alana, when I think of contact tracing, I think of how technology can be used and can be helpful, like phone apps. But what you're saying is this can be done, contact tracing can be done even without those.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen a lot of these kind of phone apps being tested out in different countries and used more or less depending on where you are. But what I'm hearing from specialists is it's a combination. And one of the biggest tools, it's not the technology itself. It's the power of trust and of talking.
So what does that mean, talking? Lay that out.
Yeah, so Marco, if you were to test positive for COVID-19, it's pretty basic in the sense that a contact tracer hired or contracted by the government would contact you and then figure out where you've been, who you might have been in close proximity with. The CDC defines a close contact as someone who's been within 6 feet of an infected person for at least 15 minutes. From there, the tracer would figure out, with your help, how to connect with those people and then walk through realistically how they could self-quarantine and then from there monitor for symptoms. This is a really critical component in communities as they wind down an outbreak in order to like end it and contain it.
Right, because otherwise, I imagine the COVID could keep flaring up and spreading. But that seems so. It seems it would require a lot of people to do the tracing.
This is a people-powered intervention. It's labor-intensive. One rather unconventional example of this that's been getting more attention lately is actually in Japan. There's hundreds of health centers already that have this kind of infrastructure in place where the health workers there at these centers have already been dealing with infectious diseases. And so they've been connecting with patients and collecting information. It's incredibly confidential, from what I understand, and they're not sharing information about neighborhoods, even where the outbreaks might be.
The World's Alana Gordon, thank you very much.
Thank you.
France saw a surge of green victories in its municipal elections this past weekend. France's Green Party, EELV, won seats in a few major French cities, putting pressure on President Emmanuel Macron's centrist En Marche party. Malcolm Ferdinand says it's good news for the environment, but he wishes the link between race and the environment were a bigger part of the conversation. Ferdinand is a political scientist at the French National Scientific Research Center in Paris, who also studies race and the environment. He says the link between the two was not strongly made during these elections, despite ongoing anti-racism protests.
There are attempts to make the link, but I don't think the link is really built yet. It is true that in Paris, like in many other countries of the world, we've seen major anti-racist protests. However, in France, we are going against the grain, so there is no debate. The anti-racist movement is really mischaracterized in the media. The French president, in a speech, said that although he condemns racism, he also condemns anti-racist activists. So many environmental activists and members of the parties, they are in support of anti-racist movement. However, one must recognize that there is not that diversity there. So it's a party that hasn't yet embraced all the diversity that exists here in France, both in mainland France, but also in the French non-sovereign territories that one called the French Outre-mer.
So the title of your latest book in English is Decolonial Ecology, Thinking of Ecology from the Caribbean World. I'm wondering if those links are being drawn in French overseas territories like Martinique and Guadeloupe, because they also had elections this weekend. Did this green wave happen there?
I mean, I myself was born and raised in Martinique, and growing up there, the relation between the colonial history and the slavery history, as well as current environmental issues, is being made daily. Now, what happens is that there is still today a very important and stringent inequalities between the French overseas territories and mainland France. Inequalities in terms of infrastructure, inequalities in terms of social rights, more unemployment, and so on and so forth. But there is also a feeling that these overseas territories are still perceived to be on the outside of what constitutes France, very much like Puerto Rico is to the States. For example, while all the major news media outlets emphasize the green wave in mainland France, they failed to mention that in Guadeloupe, we also had one city, Pointe-à-Pitre, that saw a victory from a Europe Ecology Party candidate as well. So that feeling of being left out is also something that needs to be addressed in today's environmental policies.
So back to Emmanuel Macron, what the consequences are for him and his centrist party. Will these victories put pressure on Macron and En Marche, which actually lost seats in this election?
I think they will. I think they have. I think it pushes Macron to recognize that his party hasn't lived up to the expectations, especially the expectation of young people. Macron is the one that still conceded many, many, many points on environmental issues. So now I think there is an even greater pressure for the president to act, especially seeing as his popularity has gone down and that in 2022, there will be the new presidential election. Now, what Macron has also failed to do is really embrace and recognize the dignity of the Black and Arab minorities that have protested against police violence. In my book, Decolonial Ecology, I argue for a convergence of both environmental and ecological activists and anti-racist activists. I think this is the way we can tackle ecological issues, not just from an environmentalist perspective, but also from a social justice, anti-racist, gender equality perspective. I think that's the way forward. Mm. Many activists are seeing this way as well today.
Malcolm Ferdinand with the French National Scientific Research Center in Paris. His book, Decolonial Ecology, Thinking of Ecology from the Caribbean World, will be translated into English this fall. Malcolm, thank you very much.
Thank you.
The environment is connected to so many other issues, as we just heard, racial justice. These two big stories are closely intertwined. We see this playing out across the globe. Check out the world's reporting from the front lines of these movements at theworld.org. Jobs at seafood processing plants are dangerous during the pandemic, but speaking out against an employer about bad conditions can mean trouble for migrants on work visas.
Losing a job, losing their immigration status means that not only can they get blacklisted, but also their family members. It's not only individual.
That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of WGBH Boston and PRX. The Byzantines built it as a church. The Ottomans turned it into a mosque. Secular revolutionaries converted it into a monument to two religions. Now the Hagia Sophia in Istanbul may change hands again. A court decision expected tomorrow could allow President Recep Tayyip Erdogan to turn the domed museum back into a mosque. As Duri Buscarin reports from Istanbul, that makes some people nervous.
As soon as you pass through the stone walls of the Hagia Sophia, a hot summer day melts into the passage of time. The cross-eyed cat who lives in one corner appraises a small group of tourists. To Ebru Gökteke, a Turkish tour guide based in Istanbul, it's one of the most beautiful places in the world.
It's a turning point in the history of architecture. It's one of the most amazing buildings mankind ever created on the surface of the earth.
Terraces of marble columns reach more than 100 feet above, up towards a striped golden yellow and dark blue dome, so tall and so wide it looks like it's floating over a ring of 40 windows. Mosaic angels mark each corner. In the center of the dome is a ring of Arabic calligraphy, a transcription of the 35th verse of the Quran, the verse of light. It's like a piece of the sun.
Colossal yet so elegance. It gives me goosebumps.
The original building was built in just 5 years, between 532 and 537, a physical representation of the might of the Eastern Roman Empire. As Ottomans laid siege to the capital 900 years later, the Hagia Sophia served as a last refuge.
The Ottomans conquered Constantinople on May 29, 1453. We know that that day was a Tuesday, and in 3 days' time, by that Friday, the building was converted into a mosque. This time, the building started to symbolize the conquest. It became a symbol of the conquest.
Over the next 400 years, the Ottoman Empire would grow to rule over much of southern Europe, the Middle East, and even northern Africa. And then it would lose those lands and disintegrate after the First World War. So when a group of young revolutionaries established modern-day Turkey, Gökteke explains, the Hagia Sophia again became a symbol of the secular republic.
A building like that is a real historical heritage for everybody. And that's why I do believe that everybody should be able to enjoy it fully.
But as religiously charged political parties have gained more power over the past 40 years, they've continued to bring up this idea of converting the Hagia Sophia back into a mosque. Erdogan's ruling AK party is no different. Last month, Turkish Justice Minister Abdulhamit Gül told the country's state broadcaster that this is a matter of Turkey's sovereignty, that it's been a dream for the ruling party to see the chains of the Hagia Sophia broken and the space opened for prayer. God willing, he says, we will see the return of the Hagia Sophia to its origin.
İnşallah Ayasofya'nın aslına döndüğünü hep beraber görürüz.
But what is the Hagia Sophia's original state? That means different things to different people. Alkis Korkalis is a Greek journalist who has covered Turkey for more than 20 years. He's seen three or four pushes to convert the Hagia Sophia over those years. Every time this happens, he says, Greeks take it personally.
Well, clearly, they consider it as part of their national history, the glory of the Christian Empire, or more simply, they think of it as a Greek Empire.
With a difficult history comes difficult questions, Korkalis says. Both Greece and Turkey are the stewards of buildings built by empires that no longer exist.
The dominant interpretation, especially among the populist press, which is very, very abandoned, it's that this is another act of the Turkish state against the Greeks.
Korkalis doesn't see the potential conversion of the Hagia Sophia as a message to the Greeks. This decision is about Turkish politics. Erdogan isn't sending a message to the world, he's sending a message to Turks about the role he wants religion to play in modern Turkey. To the tour guide Ebru Gökteke, the Hagia Sophia isn't about one religion or the other. It's about the long history embodied in the building.
If it's a church or if it's a mosque, there will be things hidden from the worshippers. In order to fully appreciate it, we should be able to see it as a whole.
The question of whether that will continue to be possible may be decided this week by a Turkish court. For The World, I'm Derya Buzgarin, Istanbul.
The polls are closing today after a week of voting in Russia. 206 different constitutional amendments are on the ballot, and people get a single vote, yes or no, on the entire package of changes. Among them is a provision that would get rid of term limits and potentially allow Vladimir Putin to remain in power until 2036. Russian opposition politician Vladimir Kara-Murza has been following the vote closely. Exit polls show these amendments are passing with flying colors. What does this mean for Russia?
Before I start answering your question, I think it is very important to state that half of what you just said in this sentence should be put in quotation marks. You know, exit polls, voting results. This sham procedure that Vladimir Putin's organized has nothing, and I want to stress, nothing to do with a genuine democratic vote. Had there been a real referendum on whether Putin can stay in power beyond 2024 when his current and supposedly final mandate runs out, he would have lost that referendum. That much is absolutely clear from trends in Russian public opinion. And so the Kremlin, you know, having realized full well that they would never win an honest vote, they are holding this sham exercise, this sham plebiscite. As you just said, there was a 1 week long voting. Of course, you know, every night those ballots are stored in the offices of electoral commissions with no kind of independent oversight or control. There are no international observers being invited. The only so-called international experts present are representatives of far-right parties in Europe, from Germany, Sweden, Bulgaria. You know, the far-right seems to be the biggest allies of Vladimir Putin abroad.
So for you, the outcomes of this referendum, quotation marks, it sounds like they've already been settled on. Why even hold it?
Well, because I think Vladimir Putin is obsessed with the idea of legitimacy. Otherwise, he would not have gone through this sham exercise. And I think here's where the international aspect is very important. You know, Vladimir Putin clearly wants to be accepted and recognized as a fellow legitimate leader. He wants to be invited to G8 summits. This is why, for all those years before, even while violating the spirit of the rule of law, Vladimir Putin has been careful about keeping the pretenses and sort of adhering to the letter. What's happening this week is substantively different. He chose the most unsophisticated, the most banal way that was used by dictators all over the map, from Venezuela to Egypt to Uzbekistan to Burkina Faso in previous years, and simply waiving term limits, subverting constitutional term limits to stay in power beyond the end of his mandate. And I think it is very, very important that the international community, that the democratic nations of the world, what we call the free world, led by the United States, takes a very clear position that it is not accepting this power grab, that even though Vladimir Putin has now been illegitimate de facto for a long time, he now, as of today, becomes illegitimate de jure. That is a very important stance, I think, that the international community, including the United States, should be making now. And what it means for the Russian domestic context, I think, again, you know, it's been clear for a very long time that in the system, in the authoritarian system that Vladimir Putin has created, political changes in Russia will not be decided at the ballot box. They will be one day decided on the streets. It will not happen today. It will not happen next week. It will most likely not even happen next year, but it will certainly happen much sooner than 2036.
So I know this referendum is a yes or no vote. Have you actually seen a ballot and like the list of all these 206 amendments? And where does the term limit one sit in all of that? Like, is Putin literally trying to hide that one among all these others?
They are actually trying to hide it. There was the official website set up by the Central Electoral Commission, which kind of outlines all of these amendments. They didn't mention that one, the most important one, only after it was pointed out by the media opposition groups that they had to include it on the list. But to answer your question, I haven't seen the ballot yet. I haven't voted yet myself. I'll go in a couple of hours. So as of the time of speaking to you now, I've not yet taken up my own ballot. I will do that because this is emotionally important for myself to know that I went and said no to Putin's dictatorship. There are split opinions in the Russian opposition of how to approach this exercise. Many of my colleagues, and I fully respect their view, advocate for a boycott. I subscribe myself more to the view of that, you know, we should use every opportunity we have to say no to this corrupt and dictatorial system. And so personally, I will in a couple of hours go and take up my ballot and vote no. I know it will not change anything this time. Again, as I already said, you know, in these types of authoritarian regimes, real political changes are made on the streets, not in ballot boxes.
Vladimir Karamurza, help us understand something, because Russia does have an opposition movement. You're one of the more vocal people in it. But leading up to this vote, there hasn't been a wave of protests or a strong movement to boycott the vote. Why is that?
Well, first of all, when you say that Russia has an opposition, you know, Russia had a leader of the opposition. His name was Boris Nemtsov. He was a former deputy prime minister. He's the most prominent and the most effective and the most vocal political opponent of President Vladimir Putin.
Right.
5 years ago, a little more than 5 years ago, Boris Nemtsov was assassinated, gunned down by 5 bullets in the back as he walked across a bridge right in front of the Kremlin in Moscow. So when we talk about the opposition in Russia, let's be careful about terminology. We do not have a democratic system of government. We haven't had one for almost 20 years now.
You would call it an opposition, but not a movement?
No, I mean, you're right to say, of course, we are the opposition. I just, as Boris Nemtsov himself said in one of his last interviews before his death, we should be better referred to as dissidents than opposition leaders. You asked why there are no public protests. Well, first of all, because they are banned, of course, under the pretext of the pandemic. So there's no trouble with holding a vote with tens of millions of people because of the pandemic. There's no problem there. When somebody tries to organize a rally against these amendments, oh, no, that's going to be dangerous. No rallies allowed.
I guess I'm scratching my head because last summer municipal elections prompted big demonstrations. So why is something as consequential as this raft of constitutional amendments, including waiving term limits for Putin, why is that not pushing people out into the streets for the nation?
Well, first of all, it is. As I mentioned now, as we speak, there are demonstrations breaking out in Moscow. But again,
it's a small one, isn't it?
And again, I think it might be, it's sort of obvious for me as a Russian citizen, but I think maybe it needs to be spelled out again for our audience in the United States that, you know, when people go and demonstrate in the U.S., they're constitutionally protected. You know, they have the right to demonstrate, and that right is generally respected by the authorities. You know, in Russia, when you go to demonstrate, you can be beaten up, you can be detained, you can be arrested, you could get several years' terms of prison. You know, you mentioned those demonstrations last year in Moscow. There are still people in prison today, a year after the fact, for having gone out to those demonstrations. So first of all, let's not take this lightly. You know, it's not just why don't people go out and demonstrate. People have to calculate that they can end up 10 years in prison if they go and demonstrate. But I think the astonishing fact is that even despite these repressions and despite this danger, there are still a lot of people in Russia today who are prepared to publicly voice their opposition against the Putin regime. Again, let us see what happens in the next few months, especially as these quarantine measures will be eventually lifted.
Do you believe Putin will stay in power until 2036?
No, I do not believe that for a second. And I have yet to meet a single person who actually believes that Putin will stay in power until 2036. You know, I want to remind you.
But what would stop him, Vladimir Karamurza?
Not just would, but what will stop him will be organized public resistance from Russian society. The same factor that stopped authoritarian regimes in other countries where dictators also wanted to stay in power for life for a long time, Milosevic in Serbia, Yanukovych in Ukraine, Sarkisian in Armenia, and I can long continue this list of would-be strongmen and dictators who wanted to stay in power for life until their citizens, their people, told them otherwise.
Vladimir Karamurza, opposition politician and chairman of the Boris Nemtsov Foundation for Freedom, speaking with us about Russia's sweeping vote today on constitutional amendments. Vladimir, thank you very much.
Thank you. Great to be on your program.
One of the proposals on the ballot today in Russia would enshrine heterosexual marriage in the Constitution. LGBTQ activists say the amendment would make it virtually impossible for the government to ever recognize same-sex marriages, which, as the world's Bianca Hillier reports, is just one of the freedoms that queer Russians and allies are fighting for.
John Sullivan, the U.S. ambassador to Russia, had a clear message last week as he wrapped up Pride Month in Moscow.
LGBTI rights are human rights. And human rights are universal. Our embassy is displaying the rainbow flag in solidarity with these efforts. It's as simple as that.
Simple, but in Russia, it's complicated. Ambassador Sullivan couldn't fly the rainbow flag on a pole in front of the U.S. embassy because that would be illegal. But hanging the flag between two balconies? Technically, that's okay.
I was surprised to see a rainbow flag at the embassy, because in Russia, the rainbow symbols is prohibited.
Daniel Levkin is a 21-year-old gay man who lives in Moscow. He went by the embassy this week and says seeing the flag made him feel happy.
And I'm so proud when I saw this. This is a freedom.
Levkin posted a picture of himself with the flag on Instagram. The comments on his post, and much of the overall reaction online, has been positive.
The young generation more tolerant than our parents and grandparents.
Still, the pride flag remains a symbol of, quote, gay propaganda in Russia, and is belittled by high-level authorities. The Russian Foreign Ministry commented on a Facebook photo the U.S. Embassy posted showing the flag, along with a link to this 1977 song called El Bimbo. The comment, written in English, reads, "Just to keep you in a joyful and gay mood in such hard time for America, whose idea has to be made great again." Further explanation was not offered, but that Facebook comment was followed by anti-LGBT activists picketing and stomping on rainbow flags outside the U.S. embassy. Though it wasn't just the U.S. officials in Russia publicly supporting LGBTQ rights. The British embassy in Moscow hung their own rainbow flag out front, and Ambassador Alison Leclerc, who represents Canada in Russia, criticized the lack of protections for queer Russians in a Facebook video. She says they're living in a hostile environment.
In Russia, this situation is compounded by an increase in violence and intimidation of the community by local authorities and other actors, and proposals for constitutional amendments that, if adopted, would lead to an increasingly less inclusive national legal framework.
Here, Ambassador Leclerc refers to the constitutional amendments Russia is currently voting on during a week-long referendum. One of the proposals set forth by President Vladimir Putin would define marriage as exclusively being between a man and a woman. Ambassador Leclerc's direct comments on these proposals prompted Putin allies to speak out. She will burn in hell, said Pyotr Tolstoy on the state-run Russian show 60 Minutes. Tolstoy, a member of the United Russia Party, launched into a personal attack on Leclerc, saying, "This woman, the ambassador of Canada, is a typical representative of this type of single, middle-aged dame who are activists for the promotion of LGBTQ agendas in Europe, in America, in Canada, and now here." Daniel Levkin, the young gay man I spoke to, thinks LGBTQ rights will make it to Russia.
I believe that Russia is currently closer from LGBT equality than 5 years ago, but we need time.
Time. How much time? President Putin is a strong opponent of LGBTQ rights, and one of the constitutional amendments expected to pass this week could keep him in charge until 2036. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. The pandemic continues to shed light on unsafe working conditions in industries considered essential. We first saw the impact on the meatpacking industry in the U.S. and Europe. Cramped working conditions meant workers fell ill, plants were closed, and meat supplies plummeted. Now the seafood processing industry in the U.S., which relies heavily on migrant workers, is facing similar problems. The World's Daisy Contreras has that story.
She wore two sweaters, two pairs of pants, and a hat.
Super frío, super helado. Hay veces que no controlamos el frío.
But every day Reina Alvarez worked at a seafood processing plant in Louisiana, she was still cold.
Adentro entras al lugar y son cuatro mesas, pero son larguísimas.
She'd stand at one side of the long tables, elbow to elbow with other workers. This was in April, during a pandemic. There were about 100 employees in the same room, peeling crawfish. Even while the Trump administration is suspending visas for different types of work, visas for workers essential to the food chain are untouched, at least for now. Crawfish is one of Louisiana's largest industries. Alvarez and others from her region in northern Mexico come here every year with H-2B visas. From January to July, they stay in dorms with up to 40 people. Evie Peña is with Centro de los Derechos del Migrante, a migrant workers' rights group based in Mexico and the U.S.
H-2B workers are tied to their employer by their visa, and they often live in remote and desolate areas. And their housing and transportation is provided by their employer, and this means that their access to basic services, including food and medical services, depends on their job.
In April, Alvarez started feeling ill. First came headaches, then a cough and shortness of breath. She wasn't alone. Several dozen workers at that plant in Crowley, Louisiana, also fell ill. Most kept working, but Alvarez was too sick, she says. So she and a co-worker, Maribel Hernandez, decided to go to a hospital with the help of a friend who spoke English. This is Hernandez.
Él dijo que le había dicho él que ya nos habían reportado a migración, que porque nos habíamos escapado.
Hernandez says when they checked in with their boss, he fired them and told them he had reported them to immigration authorities. Without that job, they don't have papers to work in the U.S. Peña with the workers' rights group in Mexico City says this creates a domino effect.
So losing a job, losing their immigration status means that not only could they get blacklisted, but also their family members, maybe even their entire community. So when we're talking about a financial burden, it's not only individual, it's also collective.
Both Alvarez and Hernandez filed a whistleblower complaint against their former employer, Acadia Processors, saying they were fired without a valid reason. Acadia Processors didn't respond to an interview request, but a spokesperson told the Daily Advertiser newspaper they didn't fire the workers. The workers abandoned the job. Complaints like this about retaliation and safety are common and have persisted during the pandemic, according to advocacy groups. They've urged OSHA to step up safety regulations for workers. Sabina Trejo is with the Seafood Workers Alliance in New Orleans, a workers' rights group.
So unfortunately, since there's been no enforcement throughout this crisis, the guidelines have been pretty much rendered meaningless to workers in seafood processing plants where they're not being implemented.
Last week, months into the pandemic, OSHA and the CDC released temporary guidelines for the seafood industry. They say workers need to be spread out. Trejo says those guidelines still don't address the major problem facing migrant workers, retaliation by employers.
And before the crisis as well, we saw that OSHA wasn't standing up for and protecting migrant workers and understanding the vulnerabilities.
Alvarez and Hernandez say they rely on the crawfish industry to feed their families in Mexico.
Porque yo venía a trabajar, a ganar mi dinero para mi familia, pues, o sea, la necesidad que tiene uno, pues, se aguanta muchas cosas a veces.
Reina Alvarez says the conditions and treatment she faced this year are not new in the industry. She stayed quiet before, but the pandemic convinced her to speak out, even if that risks not getting hired again.
Pero esta vez yo me olvidé de todo eso porque la verdad yo me sentía muy desesperada y me sentía muy mal.
This time around, Alvarez says she forced herself to forget about the consequences. Too much is at stake for workers like her. For The World, I'm Daisy Contreras.
The United States continues to be a global outlier when it comes to the coronavirus pandemic, escalating cases and political differences on how to intervene and control outbreaks.
I would not be surprised if we go up to 100,000 a day if this does not turn around, and so I am very concerned.
That's Dr. Anthony Fauci, the top public health official in the U.S. Join us tomorrow on The World when Fauci will be our guest and explains how the U.S. path has diverged so sharply from other Western countries. That's tomorrow here on The World. With new coronavirus outbreaks happening here and abroad, this news is hard to believe. An annual music festival in a little Serbian town is going ahead as planned in August. For 6 days, the town of Guča will host its brass and trumpet festival. The festival's website acknowledges the pandemic, says the situation in Serbia is stable, and declares that it's time to think about the good things in life. In other words, 6 days of grilled sausages, brass bands playing throughout town, and dancers following them through the streets. Groups like Jambo Agusevi Orchestra, band leader and trumpet player Jambo Agusevi could be among the performers. Securing artist guarantees has not been easy for the Guča Festival due to the pandemic and no schedule has been posted yet. Jambo Agusevi Orchestra would be a great get, though. They have a new album out and the title track is right on brand, Brasses for the Masses. With an eye on a new generation of Balkan music fans, the band raps its way through a few verses. I imagine you won't be traveling to Serbia next month for the Guča Fest. So this 4th of July, why don't you do it up early? Throw your own sausages on the grill, crank up Jambo Agusevi Orchestra, and think about the good things in life. Maybe even start your own dance party in the streets. Or at least check out the video for Brasses for the Masses. It's a lot of fun. You can find it on our Twitter feed. We are at The World. We come to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH here in Boston. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
From PRX.